Some of these great disasters have been associated with tiredness and impulsivity. So the Challenger was partly as a result of sleep loss. Three Mile Island, the Exxon Valdez, the figure of 100,000 crashes on the American freeway is probably an underestimate. Sleep is a period of physical inactivity, preventing us moving around within an environment to which we're poorly adapted, but during which time we perform essential biology, whether that be memory consolidation, getting rid of toxins, working out anxiety during REM sleep, all of those sorts of things. Anecdotally, so many of us have woken up with a problem solved. Again, going back to the wisdom of our grandparents, sleep on it. The tired brain remembers negative stuff, but forgets the positive stuff. Tired brains mean that we see the world completely different and respond to the world completely differently than if we've had a good night of sleep.
I would love to start this conversation by reading a few quotes. And these I got from you. The first quote is this, quote, "Enjoy the honeydew of slumber," from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. A second, quote, "Sleep is the golden chain that ties health and our bodies together," from Thomas Dekker. And then here's a third quote from 400 years later, quote, "Sleep is a criminal waste of time and a heritage from our cave days." That's from Thomas Edison. I wanted to start this conversation about sleep by asking you, which of those three is true, and what happened between those Elizabethan quotes and that quote from Edison in the early 20th century, in your judgment?
I think it's really fascinating that in the pre-industrial era, sleep was intuitively embraced. The heavy, what is it, the honey heavy dew of slumber, and people just sort of, I think, realized it gave them something important. And because we're such an extraordinary species that we want to control our environment, as soon as we were able to invade the night with electric light, and of course, Edison was one of the individuals behind that, we forgot about the joy and the importance of sleep. I think it's quite fascinating. It's almost as if sleep became this enemy, this creature that we had to grab and subdue and conquer, rather than being like a fuzzy, you know, friendly animal that we should hug and embrace and realize that it's such a wonderful thing for us. I think it's you know, because we can do something, we feel we just should, and we've thrown away the extraordinary benefits of sleep without really appreciating the consequences. I think that's what I would say about that transition. It's to do with modernity and industrialization, which of course have given us so much. I'm not knocking it, but you know, the downside has been that we've forgotten some of the really incredible biology that makes us this amazingly creative and wonderful species. Our ability to invent things, our ability to embrace others, and to laugh is all, you know, enhanced by our ability to have a good night of sleep.
And in your judgment, how did we lose that perspective, that understanding? Obviously, you just mentioned that, you know, the invention of electricity invaded the night, changed our experience with the night. What's your best understanding as to why we have moved away from this gift of nature so drastically?
Well, I think it's absolutely pragmatic. The people who run the factories invest enormous amounts of money into equipment, and not to have them running on a 24/7 basis was considered to be a monumental waste of money. And so it was really the drive for night shift work and a 24/7 economy, which of course has given us great benefits. And it would be naive to say we're going to put that particular genie back in its bottle. But we've got to understand the consequences, and there are things that we can do to mitigate that. And I think we're beginning to appreciate that. But the original driver was, I think, to expand the economy. You know, and of course, you know, what it has done in some sectors today. So if you speak to nurses, for example, it's the only way that they can combine a career with a family. You often hear that what I can do is I can be home to pick up the, you know, to get the kids off to school. I can then get them off to bed. And then I can go on the night shift, and then I can be back in the morning to get them back off to school. And so there are severe economic and personal drivers, and many people, you know, are forced to work the night shift just to keep, you know, the financial engine running. So there are lots of factors. It's not simply factory workers, factory owners imposing it on their workforce. It's a way of generating the income that many families need to survive.
Yeah. I know one of the more interesting things for me that I learned in researching your work is your view that the amount of the quantity of sleep that an individual might need even throughout his life changes.
Yeah.
And that, that there's a bespoke aspect to, I think, your outlook on how much sleep a healthy person really needs. That being said, I'd love to put a very simple question to you, which in your mind, where does sleep rank, or should it rank, in a sane person, in a sane society's hierarchy of health?
Well, it's it's one of the pillars of health, of course. It, like good diet, like exercise, good mental health. Sleep is one of those essential pillars of health, which we are now beginning to appreciate its importance. Which, from those of us that remember the 1980s. And you certainly won't, Dan. you know, people used to come in and say, oh, I've done another all-nighter. Whoa, you know, and they used to get pat on the back and stuff. And now, of course, you wouldn't let people into the workplace who've done an all-nighter because they would be lacking in empathy or creativity. They'd be risk-taking and they'd show increased impulsivity. And so we've really moved away from that sort of applauding lack of sleep. The only danger, of course, is that around about the turn of the century, we felt that sleep should be taken seriously. And now, of course, it's... We've got in a situation where there's a massive sleep anxiety because of the very things you've just touched on, Dan, which are, you know, you've got to get 8 hours of sleep. And there were fairly irresponsible statements a few years ago saying, if you don't get 8 hours of sleep, you're going to die young. And this is just nonsense. You know, healthy sleep, depending upon who you are, can range from 6 hours to some people may need 10 and a half, 11 hours. And it's all about defining the individual sleep needs that we have at a particular time, because it's going to change, of course, as we age. And I think that's the key thing for me. It's like shoe size. It would be absurd if we were all to wear the same shoe size. And it's the same thing about imposing the same sleep pattern on everybody. And I have to say, it's one of the reasons I wrote Lifetime, because so many people were coming up to me at public talks and were developing this anxiety about their sleep. And as I say, rather than embracing it like a fuzzy, warm animal, it was this sort of dragon they needed to slay.
I know I've heard you put it this way, that when asking oneself, how much sleep do I need, it might be best to consult the advice your grandmother probably gave you. And I'd love to open up that question for you about how someone who might come across this interview who is wondering this for themselves. I think I've heard you say, you know, a healthy amount of sleep per night can range as drastically as sub 6 hours to 10 hours or even slightly more. What advice do you give people who ask you that question that can help them to answer that question?
I think it's straightforward, and it really is sort of the wisdom of our earlier generations. You know, so basically, you know, you're not getting enough sleep if you don't feel you're performing optimally the next day. And we all, I think, know intuitively if we're not firing in all cylinders. If you need to oversleep extensively on free days, so at the weekend, for example, and you can really unmask this when you go on holiday, when you've, you know, taken a bit of a break, and then you find you're unmasking your real sleep patterns. If you are dependent upon an alarm clock or somebody else to get you out of bed, if it takes a long time to wake up, you're feeling groggy, this sleep inertia that people experience. If you feel sleepy, irritable, are tired when you are awake, if you crave a nap during the day, if you find yourself doing overly impulsive things. You know, you're going to say, yeah, I can get through that red stop, that stoplight before it turns red. You know, if you didn't have a tired brain, of course you wouldn't want to do that sort of thing. If you crave caffeinated, sugar-rich drinks to keep you going throughout the day. And it's also very important about listening to your family, your friends, your colleagues who may have noted a change in your behavior. Many of us don't respond very well to, are you feeling okay? You seem to be a bit more grumpy or irritable or a little bit lacking in empathy. But actually, that's great advice. And people aren't trying to be mean, that they are genuinely trying to help you. I think at least 80% or 90% of the time. But so if it's yes to those sorts of things, then you're not getting the sleep that you need. And what you need to do is try and structure your life so that you do go to bed earlier, if you possibly can. And I think that's what many, some very interesting study that came out recently was looking at mobile phone use. And from 2020 to 2024, so over 5 years, people were getting up at about the same time, but they were going to bed on average 20 minutes earlier. So I think people, the penny's dropping that we do have some ownership over our sleep. There are things we can do about our behavior to give us that extra sleep should we feel we need it. And I think it's particularly with the, you know, Generation Z. They are noted for their healthy eating and their exercise and their reduction in alcohol consumption. And I think they're taking their sleep more seriously. It was interesting. I was asked before Christmas, you know, what my New Year's resolution would be. And I hadn't really thought about it. And then it occurred to me, well, it was to be more like Generation Z, because certainly, certainly my generation has not been particularly good in certain areas.
I remember just as a kid that there was this, you know, in the zeitgeist, the notion that sleeping, you were weak if you wanted to sleep more, that there was a lack of toughness there. And one of the, I think, the key counterpoints that I learned from you about what sleep deprivation, the consequences of sleep deprivation, there are just three data points I want to put to you that I learned from you that I had never heard of before, which is that apparently there is some evidence that the Challenger explosion, Chernobyl, and 100,000 car accidents a year in the U.S. are, at least in some way, seem to be indicated by the poor judgment of people who are sleep deprived. And yeah. I'd love to just open up that space for you to take that wherever you'd like and speak to the negative consequences that we know about in, you know, day-to-day life, but also in history, from people making mistakes, having poor judgment because they're sleep deprived.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly important point. And of course, we're just about to start in the UK, the great parliamentary sleep survey. We've set up a survey for our members of parliament to find out how much sleep they get.
Yeah.
Because of course, these are the people making very, very important decisions. And I would be much more confident in their decision-making abilities if I knew that they were getting good sleep. It's also a great way to raise the profile of the importance of sleep. But you're right. Some of these great disasters have been associated with tiredness and impulsivity. So the Challenger, in the final report, they felt that tiredness in the officials and pushing the button to launch was partly as a result of sleep loss. Three Mile Island, you know, the Exxon Valdez. One fascinating thing about the Exxon Valdez oil tanker crash is that many people say, oh, was the captain was drunk. Well, yeah, it does seem he was drunk and asleep in his cabin. And what was happening is that was a very inexperienced, tired member of the crew driving this boat, and he was being told, turn the damn boat, turn it. But he couldn't process the information because of levels of tiredness. And this was flagged up again in the report. So many instances have been associated with that. The figure of 100,000 crashes on the American freeway is probably an underestimate. And of course, what's happening is people are chronically tired. It's a long straight road. And of course, the closer you get to home, the more relaxed you become. And it's falling asleep, this micro nap. And these crashes tend to be catastrophic because, of course, you're unaware you've fallen asleep. And so you only sort of wake up when you've smashed into something at high speed. And so, yeah, I mean, the estimates range from 100,000, and I use the lower estimates, but some put it as high as 300,000 crashes. And again, we're not making this clear. There was a study from the UK. And it showed that 57% of junior doctors, and this happened to be anaesthetists, 57% had either had a crash or a near miss driving home after the night shift. This is an extraordinary statistic, but our employers saying to those individuals, look, you need to get an app for your phone that is going to detect head nod or lateral movement of the car that will then make a sound and wake you up. Now, the technology exists, of course, to do that. In high-end cars have this technology built into them. But it's that those simple solutions to some of these problems that just aren't getting through, which is what I find deeply frustrating. And I'm sure we'll get onto this. I mean, another example, slightly tangentially, is that, you know, we find night shift workers having high rates of type 2 diabetes, coronary heart disease, obesity. What food do we make available to our night shift workers? It's vending machines full of high sugar snacks and, of course, fast food full of fat and sugar. Nobody, and I think this is true across the spectrum, has developed a high protein, easy to digest, tasty snack for night shift workers to snack on throughout the night shift. These are simple solutions to reduce. There's a very nice study that showed that your chance of getting type 2 diabetes as a night shift worker, and I think the study was over a 10-year period, was massively reduced if you kept up with your exercise and you ate well. And so yes, it's not great, but there are things that we can do to mitigate.
That's absolutely fascinating. So many of the symptoms that you ticked off there about how people behave when they're sleep deprived, the irritability, the poor judgment, the car accidents, the missteps, sound like what people often do with the negative side effects with being drunk. And no one advocates for people to get in a car anymore when they know their friends are wasted. And it does seem to me, just in my own little life, that the zeitgeist does seem to be shifting in terms of how important proper sleep seems to be moving in terms of people's priorities in their life. This might be a good transition point to talk about why sleep exists in the first place. I mean, it does seem bizarre to some degree that we spend roughly a third of our lives conked out and unconscious. I think I heard you put it that the average person is asleep for something like 36 years of their life. And I believe I got this from a presentation that you gave, that you're persuaded that the primary reason why we sleep is for brain processing and memory consolidation. And I'd love to just put that to you in as simple terms or as complicated of terms as you would like to share. But why has nature made us such intense sleepers in the first place? What's it for?
Dan, I must send you a copy of an opinion paper I wrote fairly recently. And the editor of the journal changed the title to "Is There Is No Mystery to Sleep." And so this was the argument. So we live in a world that rotates once every 24 hours. And that causes profound changes in the light environment and the temperature environment. And all life has evolved a response to that dynamic environment. So day-active animals like ourselves have got an incredible visual system that allows us to see around our world. But of course, we don't function that well at night. And in the same way, a night-active animal has all those beautiful sensory specializations that allow it to function at night, but they flounder around during the day. And this is true not just for sort of fairly complicated beasts like ourselves, but just about everything. Single-celled creatures have almost a rest activity cycle, and they're adapted to the varying demands of the light-dark cycle. Now, once you've made that decision to be active at a particular time and inactive at another time, and you've evolved the specializations to deal with those different environments, it's not a good idea to start wandering around at the wrong time of day. So there's naturally a period of inactivity and activity. So what happens during that compartmentalization of our lives? Well, of course, we do what we need to do when we're awake. We gather food, we socialize, we interact, we do all those things that we need to do when we're awake. But whilst we're asleep, we've gathered all this information during the day. And of course, we're then not overwhelmed with new information coming in. So the brain has got the capacity to start to play with this information. It starts to come up with innovative solutions to complex problems. We've built up during the day a whole bunch of toxins. And it would be crazy to flip backwards and forwards between different states. So we park those toxins and then we start processing them at night. So my definition of sleep, and I have to say, even my close colleagues don't necessarily agree with me, is that sleep is a period of physical inactivity, preventing us moving around within an environment to which we're poorly adapted, but during which time we perform essential biology, whether that be memory consolidation, getting rid of toxins, you know, working out anxiety during REM sleep, all of those sorts of things. So it's a compartmentalization of stuff in time, doing the appropriate stuff at across the rest activity cycle. So that's, yeah, I must send you that paper to see what you think about it. But that makes sense. So there is no sort of magical about sleep. It's a period of physical inactivity where we can undertake a whole bunch of essential stuff.
Yeah. Fascinating. I'd love to take a look at that paper. I mean, I think I heard you say that there was a period of time when it was commonly believed that nothing was going on inside a person when they were sleeping, and nothing could be further from the truth. And I knew I wanted to give you some space to go over what we now know about what is happening as a biological entity during those roughly 8 hours on average that people tend to be asleep. What's happening to a person when they conk out and go night-night?
So I think some wonderful experiments over the past few years, one of which was by a German researcher. And he developed a very tough cognitive task. It was really quite tough to solve. And he had three different groups of individuals. One group were introduced to the task. They became familiar with the task in the morning, and they performed the task that afternoon. And about 20% of the group solved this tough problem. The next group were introduced to the task in the morning, became again familiar with it, and were then asked to solve the task the next afternoon, but they'd been deprived of a good night of sleep. And again, about 20% of the group solved the problem. The third group, and this is the really interesting group, introduced in the morning, performed it the following afternoon with a normal night of sleep, 60 to 70% of the group had solved the problem. And I think it's such a brilliant illustration of the fact that this is not downtime. You know, we've got all this information and we're beginning to play with it. And I think anecdotally, so many of us have woken up with a problem solved. Again, going back to the wisdom of our grandparents, sleep on it. And it certainly happened to me. I've sort of struggled with some scientific problems, and then I've worked out that, oh yes, of course it's that. And then you go and devise the experiment and test it. The benzene ring came up with a solution to that. He was trying to work out how benzene was constructed, and he couldn't do it. It was a linear molecule. And then he dreamt of a snake biting its tail, And the structure of benzene, you know, he woke up and realized in the morning, that's what it must be. And so I think that's been some of the most wonderful stuff that's emerged. You know, we're not just laying down facts, but we're playing with information. And I think it's so cool. The other thing that we've learned is the way in which the tired brain remembers things. And this is so fascinating. Where individuals were asked to remember words with a different content, words associated with joy, happiness, you know, love, friendship, or other words, hate, crime, war, or neutral words, things like cotton. And one group were denied sleep one night, and the other group slept normally. Now, overall, the ability to remember words was significantly reduced, showing that, yes, you need a good night of sleep to remember stuff. But when you divided it up, there was no statistical difference with the neutral words. There was no statistical difference with the negative words. But the huge drop was in the ability to remember words associated with positive feelings, love, joy, happiness, friendship. And what that showed, and other experiments have followed, is that essentially the tired brain remembers negative stuff but forgets the positive stuff. And you could see why that would be of survival value. And if you're tired, you need to be aware of what might cause you danger. And so the logic is there. But for us, you know, tired brains mean that we see the world completely different and respond to the world completely differently than if we've had a good night of sleep. So absolutely, so much interesting stuff is going on. And of course, we touched on this, but and the toxin clearance, there's this newly discovered sort of waste disposal unit that's been called the glymphatic system. And misfolded proteins called beta amyloid are the ones that have been linked that clog up cells and are associated with dementia and Alzheimer's. And now there's good data showing both from animal studies and human studies that during sleep, we clear beta amyloid from the brain. And so this would suggest, and I wouldn't say that if you didn't get sleep, you're going to get dementia, but if you're at risk, then this is one of those things that is not going to help you. And a very recent paper just came out a few weeks ago showed that, and I don't think it's been fully published. I think it's out online. Really fascinating, showing that certain sleeping tablets, and we know that sleeping tablets and alcohol don't provide a biological mimic for sleep. They actually will suppress memory formation and the processing of information. But this study showed that the clearance of beta amyloid, for example, was impaired if people were using sleeping tablets, which again is sometimes you need to use them for short periods. Yeah, of course. But sustained use could well be one of those things we'd like to avoid because of the failure to get rid of some of these misfolded proteins, which again might predispose us to conditions like dementia. So yeah, a lot of good stuff's going on.
Absolutely fascinating. And this might be a good point to transition to another key point about sleep in general, which I know you write about and have brought to my attention, which is the role of sleep in mental illness. How I know you write in your book about, I think it's about a study done with colleagues of yours related to schizophrenia.
Yeah.
I have, you know, some personal friend who has bipolar disorder, and he has told me about how he can tell fairly quickly about, that he's going into a bipolar phase because of how much his sleep is being affected. I'd love to just open this up to you to speak at whatever length you might like to what we know now about the role of sleep and poor sleep specifically in mental health in general.
So I got into this area a long time ago when I happened to be traveling in an elevator in a London hospital. And I was in this elevator with a psychiatrist, and he said, "Oh, you work on sleep, don't you?" And I said, "Well, you know, kind of." And he said, "Well, of course, my patients with schizophrenia, they have terrible sleep. That's because they don't have a job." So they go to bed late, wake up late, miss my clinic and don't have friends. And he had completely, and this is a senior psychiatrist, had completely dismissed the poor sleep that he was seeing due to a lack of social structure. In the same way, other psychiatrists have said, well, of course, this is the poor sleep is just a side effect of the drugs that individuals are on, forgetting the fact that Kraepelin, back in the 1880s, was talking about poor sleep in people that we now call individuals with schizophrenia. And so it's just been kind of dismissed. And I got really quite irritated with this. And it triggered a collaboration with another psychiatrist. And what we did, and Katarina Wolf was critical in these experiments, is monitor the sleep-wake activity of individuals with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, unemployed individuals, and healthy age-matched controls. And when I saw the patterns of disrupted sleep in schizophrenia, it's one of those, you know, moments where the hair on your arms sort of go up, because I didn't expect it to be great, but I didn't expect those rhythms to be completely smashed, absolutely smashed. Incidentally, the unemployed were no worse than the employed. So completely, it wasn't an artifact of unemployment. We also had some preliminary analysis that you couldn't link it to any particular drug people were on. And that made me think about, well, what's the relationship between sleep disruption and mental illness? And it occurred to me that as we were understanding much, much more about the mechanisms that were generating the sleep-wake cycle, it was clear that every brain neurotransmitter is involved in sleep at some level. So if there's a change in a neurotransmitter that, let's say, predisposes you to a mental health condition, it's almost certainly going to have an impact upon sleep. And so at the core, there's a mechanistic overlap in the pathways generating sleep and mental health. And we tested that. It was quite fascinating. So there have been neurotransmitters and proteins that have been linked, genes that have been linked to mental illness. And we decided to take one of those genes. And of course, these conditions are multigenic. So this is not causative, but this is one of the genes that's been associated. And we mutated that in a mouse. And what was so extraordinary is that it smashed the sleep-wake cycles of these mice. So there's now lots of evidence that these two systems overlap. But of course, and that would explain why, you know, there's a genetic predisposition for some individuals to have a mental health condition. But it's more complex than that. Because poor sleep drives poor health, then that's going to, and particularly poor mental health, as we've discussed, a negative salience, you know, you remember the negative stuff, increased impulsivity, a tendency to use stimulants and sedatives more. That's going to make the mental health status worse. And of course, the mental health status, because of potentially drugs, but not necessarily, but certainly because of the psychosocial effects, you realize you're not firing on all cylinders. You know, that feeds in, it increases anxiety and makes the sleep worse. So you wrap into that vicious cycle of worse sleep, worse mental health, worse mental health, worse sleep. And that then becomes a positive feedback loop. We said, okay, here's a model that we can test. So if we take individuals with and this, the first study was with a colleague in psychiatry, Dan Freeman, who were on the psychosis spectrum. They were showing hallucinatory experiences and paranoia, and they had terrible sleep. And using digital cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, we were able to reduce the insomnia and spectacularly reduce the levels of paranoia and hallucinatory experiences. And that was the first demonstration that this model, this relatively simple model, we had proof of principle. And so if you can think of sleep as a new therapeutic target. If you can stabilize it, even partially, you could reduce the severity of psychiatric symptoms. And I think this is so good. You were talking about, your friend, and knows if they're going to slide into a worse mental health status because they start to see their sleep falling apart. Now, if only we could stabilize that, you'd stop that slide into a worse state and kicking off that positive feedback. And you're quite right. It's well known that in depression and other mental health states, a pattern of disrupted sleep always precedes these sorts of issues. One thing you mentioned, bipolar, we had some fascinating studies. And again, this is working with another friend in psychiatry, Guy Goodwin. And he developed some ways in which you could predict whether people were at low risk or high risk of developing bipolar based upon family history questionnaires and stuff like that. And we looked at low risk versus high risk individuals and their sleep pattern. And what was so fascinating is that the high risk individuals had no diagnosis of bipolar, but were already showing disrupted sleep. Again, reinforcing that connection between the two systems. But the next jump has not been made. If you take those high-risk individuals and do everything you possibly can to stabilize sleep-wake, will you delay the onset of these conditions? Or indeed, while the brain is still plastic, will you knock the brain into a different developmental trajectory whereby these conditions will be less severe or may not occur at all? So I think there's some really important stuff here. And it's very interesting because I think all the fun stuff in science often occurs at the interface between disciplines. So, you know, the first psychiatrist I met, when we talk about this, it just irritated the hell out of me. And then I've been able to work with psychiatrists here in Oxford where they understand the model and they've been willing to try different interventions. And now I think sleep is considered a really important diagnostic as an early warning for the potential onset of a mental health state, and I think so importantly as a target to mitigate some of that severe mental health status. Yeah, I think it's really exciting times, and it's generally changing psychiatry. But psychiatry is a fascinating. I mean, I remember working with yet another colleague, Paul Harrison, and said to Paul, he's a very fantastic psychiatrist, very demanding schedule, big clinical load, and he said to me, I said to him actually, Paul, why are you spending all this time? We're writing these grants together. We're devoting an awful lot of your energy into this sector. And he said, well, you don't understand. I went into psychiatry because I wanted to understand the human brain. And then I discovered that half my colleagues feel that their work has got nothing to do with the brain and neuroscience, but the mind. And still embedded in psychiatry is this duality of the brain as something that is not the mind, which is not an emergent property of the brain. And he said, so any neuroscientist like you who shows an interest in psychiatry, we're going to grab hold of and work with. And so it was enlightening for me because he gave me that, because I think as a neuroscientist, it's so glaringly obvious that, mental illness is the product of changes in the brain. And the mind is some ephemeral vapor sort of drifting somewhere that people still believe in. And I find that extraordinary. And so I think also, as psychiatry is becoming more embedded within neuroscience, then the sorts of things like sleep and all the rest of it are being adopted more readily.
Fascinating. And is it your view, given what you just said about the early indicators when someone knows that they have a propensity or a history of mental illness and their sleep begins to suffer, that it's possible that hypothetically the most important thing they can do, and I think you alluded to this, is to do everything they can to, number one, to begin to stabilize their sleep? And if you agree with that, and maybe this also is advice for people who may not be suffering from mental illness, what can they do? What are the empowering pieces of knowledge, right? This is all about trying to help people and give them information that hopefully can mitigate their own suffering and improve their health. What can be done in your mind? And maybe we can start specifically with people that are suffering from mental illness when they start to notice that, you know, their sleep is beginning to, you know, as you said, just get crushed. What would you recommend they do, or at least might they think about trying to improve that?
Well, I think this is such an important point, because so many people feel that you get the sleep that you get, and that we have no control over it.
Yeah,
and yet it's a dynamic, complicated behavior that we have an awful lot of control over. And that's why I think an education in the areas of sleep and circadian rhythms is so important. I know I keep on going on about this, but particularly in the young, while the brain is still plastic, you know, it's in adolescence where, you know, many mental health conditions arise. And if only we had good sleep, circadian education in our schools, we might be able to stop that slide. But what can you do? And I should say, we've done some studies, preliminary studies on kids in the age of around about 13, 14. And we worked with teachers to generate lessons. It was 8 30-minute sessions with their teacher, but we'd worked with the teacher working out the materials. And we'd also produced a small single page, you know, folded pamphlet for parents about the importance of sleep. And we looked at the quality of the sleep before the intervention and then after. And what was so fascinating, those 20% of kids who were showing really quite severe sleep disruption, after the education alone, we moved the average away from that severe scale. So we know that you don't have to change school start times. You just need to get the message out there. Okay, so what can you do? I bang on about this endlessly, but it's getting that morning light, because what the morning light will do is set the clock, and that sets the sleep-wake cycle, and it provides stability. And it's worth bearing in mind about the mechanisms that generate our circadian system. We've got a master clock in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nuclei, and it's a bit like the conductor of an orchestra, producing a regular beat from which the body takes its cue. Now, the master clock is aligned to the light-dark cycle outside, the dawn-dusk cycle, so the internal day matches the external world. A classic mismatch, of course, would be jet lag. Then several signals, neural and hormonal, from the master clock, then coordinate the rhythmic activity of the rest of the body. Now, what we used to think is that the master clock forced rhythmicity. You know, it imposed a pattern. And now we know that's not true. Every cell in the body seems to have the capacity to generate a circadian rhythm. So what this master clock is doing, set by the external light-dark cycle, is to regulate the activity of billions of individual cellular clocks distributed throughout the organ systems of the body. And going back to our orchestra analogy, if the master clock, the conductor, and the members of the orchestra are all aligned to each other, you get a symphony. But if there's disruption, then you get a cacophony. And that's what happens if you don't get a robust setting of the external light-dark cycle. Everybody in the orchestra starts to play at a slightly different time, and you have this ghastly noise. So the morning light is so important. And that's for 90% of us. If you happen to be a really, really early bird, an extreme lark, then it may well be that dusk light is more important. Now, let me unpack that. Morning light advances the body clock, makes you get up earlier and go to bed earlier. Dusk light delays the body clock. You go to bed later and get up later. We did a study on university students all over the world a few years ago, showing that the later the chronotype, the more owl-like they were, the less morning light they got, which would make them get up earlier, and they got much more late afternoon evening light, which of course would push the clock later. And so what's happening from our observations, particularly in schizophrenia, is that many people are sort of awake during the night, they're asleep across the morning. And so it's so important to impose that light-dark cycle. And if you can't get outside, which is the optimum, then you can use a light box. And so 30 minutes, 10,000 lux, being very effective at stabilizing the sleep-wake cycle and improving mental health. So if you're tired during the day, it's suggesting you're not getting enough sleep at night. But if you need to nap, make sure that it's not more than 20 minutes. And around about lunchtime, quick 20 minute nap means that the second half of the day, you can perform a bit better. But ideally, you shouldn't have a nap. It's no great, I mean, again, it's hard and fast. It's no great disaster if you do. Where it becomes a problem, again, is in adolescence. So what you find is that, in fact, adolescents are programmed biologically to go to bed later and get up later. But then that's exaggerated with smartphones, social media, gaming until the early hours of the morning. So they have shortened nighttime sleep. They then struggle through the school day, sometimes literally falling asleep at their desks. They then get home. Then they will have a 2-hour sleep, which is relatively close to bedtime. That pushes the drive for sleep back, meaning it's more difficult to get to sleep that night. So again, we fall into a vicious circle of reduced nighttime sleep, poor daytime activity, longer naps in the afternoon. And that cycle is dangerous and must be broken. Exercise. There's been good data showing that exercise can, again, enhance the stability of the circadian system. So a morning run outside has been shown to be very effective. I think exercise during most periods of the day are fine. Don't make it too late, because what that can do is drive up core body temperature before you go to bed. And in fact, part of going to sleep is a drop in body temperature. And if you block that, it's more difficult to go to sleep. The key thing, the absolutely overwhelmingly key thing, is that most people don't have a sleep problem. They have an anxiety or a stress issue. And it's so important to get that under control. And I have to say, I used to be a bit rude about things like mindfulness. But now the data are very clear. For some people, a relaxation technique, call it mindfulness if you like, can really help improve their sleep. So do the things that allow you to relax. So those are some things you can do during the day before you go to bed. Keep light levels low, because the higher the light, the greater the alertness, which is going to make it more difficult to fall asleep. Stop using your electronic devices. I know it's difficult. I remember when I first got my BlackBerry, and you can tell how old that must be. I had to leave it in the lab because I was fixated on this little red light that was glowing, you know, from the emails coming in from the States or wherever. And I had no control. So I had to just physically separate myself from it. It's tricky. We've touched on avoiding sedatives, whether they be alcohol or drugs. Short-term use, I think that's fine. And you know, interacting with your healthcare provider is really important in that. And they tend to only prescribe for about a week or so. And that can be useful in sort of correcting a really difficult, you know, set of circumstances and sort of sedating you. And that can be useful under certain circumstances. But where it's bad is if you become dependent upon it. And what you find is if people aren't being given sedatives by their healthcare provider, they'll go and use antihistamines, which will pass the blood-brain barrier and can be extremely effective at sedating individuals. And that really is not a good idea at all. One obvious thing, and you certainly do it in my household, is you don't discuss stressful topics immediately before bedtime. Now, some of the only time that couples have together is, you know, lying in bed at the end of the day because it's all been crazy. There's jobs, there's kids, there's whatever. And then you're lying there. And then you want to discuss family finances, the fact that the gutters fall, you know, got full of leaves. And so this is really bad. And it sounds so laughingly obvious, but, you know, we ban any discussions like that. And if we come close, I say, nope, zip, zip, nope, none of that. We'll make time to discuss it tomorrow. again, it's all about winding down before you go to bed as well. It may well be, I mean, I don't read scientific papers. I can't. I mean, I will listen to some music, or I'll watch some rubbish television or something. Whatever works for you to take you outside of the stresses that you're experiencing during the day. Make sure the bedroom isn't too warm. We touched on temperature, and I think many people overheat their houses. Very interesting difference between men and women. Men tend to have require a cooler bedroom compared to women. And I was in Australia a few years ago, and somebody was saying that a cooling fan had saved their marriage, because it was on one side of the bed and the chap was getting cool air, and it wasn't affecting his partner on the other side of the bed. So, yeah, I mean, be careful about that. If you're living in a noisy environment, then consider white noise generation. That can be useful, or the sounds of the sea. Try and keep it dark, as we've touched on. It's very difficult, I know, but try and make the bedroom a haven for sleep. During COVID, of course, and you still see it, so many bedrooms were turned into offices. And in a sense, if you've got the computer or the television or whatever in the same room that you're trying to sleep, it's really deeply unhelpful. So try and remove them. One other thing is not to clock watch. So one fascinating thing, of course, is that if you wake up in the middle of the night and the first thing you do is look at your illuminated clock, you think, oh, my God, I've only got 3 hours before the alarm goes off. Now, it doesn't matter how long you've got. It's when the alarm goes off. And so I strongly recommend covering the face of those digital things. And it's very tricky, of course, because many people use their smartphones as alarm clocks as well. I think an old non-illuminated clock of some sort is probably the way to go. God, I'm sounding like a Luddite. Don't take sleep apps seriously. They have the potential of being quite useful. And let me explain what I mean. If you want to lose weight, you change your eating behavior. And then you weigh yourself on a set of scales in the morning, and you see that change behavior has had an effect. So that reinforces the change behavior. And sleep apps could be useful for that. You know, if you feel you need to get more longer sleep or a slightly different time sleep, they could be useful for that. But that's not how they're used. You get a report at the in the morning of you've had good sleep or bad sleep or not enough slow wave sleep or too much REM sleep, all this sort of thing. And this is really misleading. A single app cannot be used to sort of impose, to calculate what your sleep structure is. And what does it tell you anyway? You know, if you're not getting enough slow wave sleep, well, there's not a lot you can do about it other than, you know, embracing sleep and getting natural sleep. And so I think they can be very, very anxiety making. So many people have come up to me after public talks and said, I'm being told this. One example, this chap said to me, do you believe in slow wave sleep? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, I'm not sure that I do because my app is telling me I'm not getting enough. And I said, okay, well, it's really, they're very inaccurate. I wouldn't worry about it. And, you know, he said, no. I know how important slow wave sleep is. So this chap, I kid you not, was setting his alarm clock to wake himself up at 3 o'clock in the morning to check how much slow wave sleep he was actually getting as recorded by a deeply inaccurate app. So they have the potential to be useful, I think, as AI increases and you can get a dynamic algorithm that can then extract, you know, reliable biometrics. It could be useful. But on the other hand, I mean, we go back to our criteria of how do you know if you're not getting, you know, a good night's sleep? Do you function during the day and all the rest of it? And so many people, actually, I have that conversation. I say, you know, they say, I have terrible sleep, awful sleep. And I say, well, can you function during the day? Oh, yeah, no, I'm fine during the day. And, you know, are you irritable? No, I'm fine. So you're getting a good night of sleep. so, yeah, be careful about those apps. when you're in bed, again, it's all about routine. You know, eat at the same times, go to bed at the same time, even on free days, if you possibly can. It's all about structure, and that structure works its way through the sleep-wake timing process. I'm not sure about Americans. I can't remember from the 8 years I was there. I think you take your mattresses and pillows more seriously than we Brits do. I think we're slightly cheesy, actually, about it. I think we resent buying an expensive mattress or a wonderful down-filled pillow or duvet or whatever. Invest heavily in something that you can envelop yourself in and really enjoy. And, you know, it's a simple equation. You spend 30% of your life or more in bed. It's crazy to use bedding that doesn't make you want to go to sleep. Keep bedside lights low. We've touched on that. One thing that I've gone backwards and forwards about, and that's defining the sleep space using particular smells. Lavender oil is often used. Now, the data supporting this scientifically above placebo isn't absolutely clear, but many people say, you know, if I'm away from home, I take a drop of my husband's aftershave or partner's perfume, and it immediately transports me back into the comfortable space that I know. They relax more and they get off to sleep more. And so defining your sleeping space with a particular smell can be, I think, under certain circumstances, useful for some. Now, what about if your partner snores? Now, I've been talking about this for quite some time, and it's now, as a discipline, taken off. I've basically said, look, if your partner snores and you've checked it's not obstructive sleep apnea, but they are disturbing your sleep, it's no reflection on your relationship if you sleep in separate rooms, because it means you'll both get a good night of sleep, which you'll enjoy each other's company more. You can have rituals about who's going to bring in the cup of tea or the cup of coffee in the morning. It's you know, hello, did you sleep well? Yes, it was great. It's all lovely stuff. But certainly, particularly for an older generation, if you say, oh, you can sleep in separate rooms, they say, no, it's the beginning of the end. And of course it isn't. It's the beginning of a better relationship. And in fact, it's interesting. A kid after, again, a public lecture came, he kind of be more than 24, 25. He came up to me and said, how old do you have to be before you can sleep in separate rooms? it's fine. And then I think finally, if you wake it in the middle of the night, and many people do, particularly as we age, stay calm. Roger Eckert, and you might want to get him on your program as a social scientist, has made some very interesting observations about the nature of sleep in the pre-industrial era. And it wasn't this single block, but it was biphasic. You go to bed, you go to sleep, you then wake up, you go back to sleep again. Or it can be polyphasic, and you can wake up several times. There's been some criticism by other social scientists at the moment, but what those observations, and I have to say I'm persuaded by them, that they made a chap called Tom Weir then do some experiments, and he gave young people 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness in the lab, and he found that given the opportunity to expand your sleep episode, it became biphasic or polyphasic. So if you wake up, first of all, it's not, oh my God, that's it, I may as well start doing emails and drinking coffee. It's stay calm. You may want to leave the sleeping space, sit in the sitting room under dim light, reading a few pages of Jane Austen, whatever. And then when you're willful, tired again, then you can go back to sleep. I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night fairly often. And my trick is in the BBC have a thing called Radio 4 Extra. And it's the dramas, and some of these dramas go back, you know, decades. And you can plug into an Agatha Christie or a Lord Peter Wimsey or some other gentle, there's another program called In Our Time where they will, it's very popular in the UK. And people will discuss everything from sort of Japanese porcelain to, Plato or whatever. And it's non-threatening, it's calming, and I'm usually away in 5 minutes. And I have to then, you know, capture the program at some point the next day to find out what happened. But again, it's techniques that we all can develop, as long as you're under the premise, this is perfectly fine, you almost certainly will go back to sleep. If you don't go back to sleep, it doesn't matter skipping one night or two. I mean, it's all about, you know, ultimately getting the sleep that you need. So stay calm and just, you will get back to sleep.
Yeah, brilliant. I just know in my own life that prioritizing my own sleep, and I love a lot of what your outlook is of it. It really depends on the person. This is something that each individual probably would benefit from, just tinkering with different adjustments to see what works for them. And no one will really know that from the outset before you begin to experiment with your own life and yourself. And for me personally, I had a hell of a time falling asleep earlier in the night. And so I was waking up far later than I would ideally like to, simply moving my television into the closet and making that I'm addicted to long form interview podcasts. That's my nerdy vice at the end of the day. And so I could just watch those for hours. That simple adjustment of getting screens out of my face, dimming the lights, making an environment like you just alluded to that's comfortable and cool. I'm now going to bed 2 or 3 hours earlier than I was a year ago, and it's completely changed how I experience my day. And I've moved sleep up to being, along with exercise every day, the most important thing that I really prioritize. I really hope a lot of the observations and adjustments you just mentioned might resonate with people, even if they just want to try them to see if they might help. I know we're getting very short on time, and so I wanted to close with a question about a subject I've never heard you talk about. And also, please feel free, if there's anything else in your closing, you know, answer you might like to address that, you know, you have wanted to correct or add on with your many prior podcast interviews that you think is important for the public to know. But for people that are having kids, I've seen this with my own eyes, that this sleep deprivation and the difficulty of going through that, and I know you're a parent, is often just extremely challenging, because it's like dropping a nuclear bomb in your day-to-day life. I'd love to ask you about what advice you might have for people. Obviously, it's going to be a challenge. I don't think there's any way around that, especially for the mom. Yeah. But I'd love to have you speak to that.
Well, this is, I think, such an important topic, Dan. And I think we also, the way we bring up kids now is fundamentally different from the way that children were brought up 2 or 3 generations ago. We've gone from the extended family, where there were aunts and cousins and mothers and all the rest of it living in close proximity. May not be in the same house, but they were all living fairly close. And childcare was distributed through the family or friendship group. It was known mums needed a break. Then, with increasing wealth, we've gone from the extended family to the nuclear family within a few generations. And nobody's actually pointed out to young parents that what they're trying to do, which is be the sole caregivers to the children, is just not what we evolved to do, and particularly for the mum. So the mum feels completely inadequate because she's tired, not functioning optimally, and therefore can't cope, and feels that I should be able to cope with this. But that's not how we've evolved to deal with it. The demands of child rearing are such that it's always been a distributed responsibility. If you look at the other primates, childcare again is distributed across multiple members of the family group. So, of course, we live in complex times. So what can you do? Well, before the baby arrives, you establish a network. You get a group of friends, maybe family, whoever, to say, look, there's going to be times when I need to call you up and say, I need 2 hours. Can you just come over? And I just need to catch up with some sleep. And I think that it's getting that support and not feeling guilty about being tired, that we've got to convince young parents, and particularly young mothers, that it is no shame to feel tired. You can't be expected to cope on your own. Seek help, get help, and get it organized well in advance.
I love that. And maybe as an additional closing statement, I'd love, or question for you, I'd love to have you address, you know, in, we live in similar cultures in the West, you in the UK, me in America. And I know you lived here, I think you said, for 8 years.
Yeah.
How would a healthy, sane culture prioritize or address or change in order to move sleep into its proper place in your judgment of a healthy life, a healthy society, all of the benefits that come from having well-rested people as neighbors, as friends, as coworkers? Maybe we can close on that, of what, you know, your vision might look like for the future of how a better society might function with better sleepers.
Well, first of all, I would recommend that people stop listening to the sergeant majors of sleep screaming, you must do this, you can't do that. It's about finding out what works for you. Clearly, there are some guidelines and some advice that one can take on board. But as we've discussed, you know, sleep is dynamic and very different between people. So that would be the first point. The second point is that part of what makes us the most extraordinary animal on the planet is our creativity, our ability to solve problems, our ability to interact, usually constructively, with others, our ability to see the funny side of life. There's community, all of those wonderful parts that we all want to embrace about civilized living are enhanced by sleep. And so the sooner we realize that, I think the better. And if you're an employer wanting to get the best out of your employees, you need to make sure that they're given the appropriate education about their sleep. They're not getting it at school, as we've discussed. And it's worth bearing in mind that the divorce rate for some night shift workers can be 6 times higher than the same job during the day shift. And it gives you that sort of sense of what's going on. And we go right back to where we started, which is, sure, there's an economic driver. You just can't put the 24/7 society back in its bottle. But if your partner knew that you haven't turned into a monster, but these irritability, this frustration, this anxiety is a product of your biology being driven outside of its normal range. And one needs to think very, very seriously about whether the benefits outweigh the costs. And of course, we don't have that debate at a society level, and we often don't have that debate within our family or partner groups.
Brilliant. This is so, I think, important and fascinating. I really appreciate the work that you do and spending so much of your career on this. And thank you so much for coming on the show and doing this. This was great.
Well, Dan, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun, and best of luck with everything that you continue to do.
Thank you.